Welcome to the Criterion Chat, a podcast dedicated to discussing the Criterion Collection and cinema. I'm Nate Myers, joined by Matt Peterson, as we journey to the front with J.W. Pabst's West Front 1918. At the dawn of the talking pictures, while movies were still learning to talk, George Wilhelm Pabst, who himself had been arrested and held as an enemy alien in France during the Great War, set his sights on an adaptation of Ernst Johansson's Fear von der Infanterie, a novel depicting the devastation of trench warfare on both soldiers and civilians. Now titled West Front 1918, Pop's cinematic telling of World War I's final year mixes location and stage photography to create a claustrophobic view of life in the trenches as bombs and gunfire engulf the various German soldiers in the trenches, just as poverty and social dissolution wreak havoc upon their families back home. With a bleak and unsentimental look at its subject matter, West Front 1918 quickly fell out of favor with the rise of the Third Reich and spent several decades in obscurity until being rediscovered by critics in the later part of the 20th century. Released by the Criterion Collection on Blu-ray and DVD in 2018, G.W. Pabst's plea for peace has been fully restored and packaged with a nice selection of supplements. Join Matt and me as we head into no man's land with West Front 1918. Well, Matt, we are coming here to our first film from Germany that we'll discuss on the collection. I think we have hit... Actually, no, we did... Did we do Phoenix as an episode in the early years?
Yeah, I think... I want to say that was our second episode, something like that, very early.
Okay, so I guess we have done one German film before this, but it's been a while. And yeah. I've been circling around thinking it would be nice to kind of hit that part of cinema again. And so I had a couple in mind, but this one came to me because I don't think we've really focused a lot on those first years of sound pictures. We've done some silent films. We've done, obviously, a lot of films from the 21st century and then throughout the second part of the 20th century. But the 1930s are mostly, I think, a forgotten decade because there were just those initial years of some stagnant filmmaking because sound had just so radically altered the way movies were made. And I thought West Front 1918 is kind of an interesting look at those early years of how to try to handle the technology of sound while also still trying to be cinematically expressive. There's obviously some limitations that do exist. I think anybody watching this now, nearly a century later, can see that. But there's also some interesting things taking place here in the infancy of sound filmmaking. So I thought it'd be an interesting movie for us to examine, and I'll just kick it over for you to share your initial thoughts.
Yeah, your German pronunciation is excellent, I have to say. Beyond that, though, yeah, this is my first time watching this, so it was interesting to see this film, especially given the time it was made. I mean, this is pretty close to the time of World War I, right? So you're going to have real veterans watching this film, and I have to imagine it would have been quite startling for audiences at the time. You know, early sound films are always kind of a mixed bag for me because you really have to view them with the understanding that the sync sound was a very new experience, right? It was a very novel thing because there are a lot of limitations that come from it. I mean, the camera work tends to be quite stagnant. There tends to be extended musical sequences in the film that really showcase that synchronized sound, right? And it's kind of showing off this new technology. It's not necessarily very important to the story. And this film has some of that too. I mean, you have some of those stage sequences. You have some scenes where characters are singing for longer periods of time. And they're well-done scenes, but they're not necessarily integral to the plot or the characters in the film. But that aside, you know, I never felt like this film was really limited by the fact that they were recording sound. Like, the camera work is pretty dynamic in this film, especially in the trench sequences, right? So there's a lot of tracking shots. the sound effects they're piecing together are not always the most effective or very well synchronized, but you could see what they were going for here. Like, they were really, you know, Pabst was really trying to create a dynamic film and to really deliver an experience of war that is quite unflinching and very much an anti-war message. So you could see how this would have made a very big impact upon its release.
I want to pick up on your point about this having been made so close to World War One. I mean, I was thinking, if, you know, it's not like it'd be any different than somebody making a film about Afghanistan right now in the U.S., right? I mean, it's still very fresh, but it's also, you know, got a little bit of distance where you've had some time to reflect about the nature of the war and the impact it might have had on a generation, on a civilization. This is a film that, you know, as I mentioned in my introduction, Pabst himself had been traveling abroad, trying to recruit people actually to join in the American cinema. And then because of the nature of the war, he got stuck in Europe and was arrested by the French as an enemy alien. The lead actor, Gustav Diesel, who plays Karl, himself had been in the war and had been in the prisoner of war camp during it, right? So I think it's not just even in the people who would have been seeing this, but even the people who made it, that there was a freshness and an awareness of the war that does come through. You know, there's a natural comparison to this and All Quiet on the Western Front, which came out the same year, based on the novel, also from a German perspective, so there's a lot of parallels. And that being made as an American film definitely has, from what I can see, clearly I'm guessing a much bigger budget than West Front 1918 had. There's a lot more elaborate staging of battle scenes in that than there is in this. There's probably a lot more success, actually, as an overall film. But there is a kind of narrative thrust to that that feels different than this one does, because Louis Milestone, who makes All Quiet on the Western Front, was not a veteran of World War II, or excuse me, of World War I. And so he's approaching it more as a story to tell, right? And the actors in it are American actors playing Germans, and so they would not have lived this. There might have been a few people around who had memories and experiences of the war as Americans who traveled over to Europe at the final end there. But the fact that you have a whole civilization that dealt with this, and then you're yourself living in a country that in the decade following this had to deal with the fact that you had a generation of men that died, families that were disrupted. In Germany's homeland, it wouldn't have been, of course, as devastating as in France's, but they all would have seen firsthand the war. And I think that comes through here because it is so much closer. I was just thinking about this compared to, say, and this is not by any means meant as a knock against it, but Paths of Glory, another World War One film showing trench warfare. Obviously, that one's a little bit more of a actual, you know, kind of legal thriller because it's dealing with a court-martial. Mm-hmm. But that feels different than this even. Even though, like, this is much more primitive in every way, in terms of the camera movement, the sound synchronization, all of that is a lot weaker here. But there's a kind of force within it that still makes, a fairly strong impression upon an audience all these years later.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of an unusual film, right? Because it's very much an ensemble picture. We're not really following one character throughout the whole film. I mean, the character of Karl, I guess if you had to pick, you know, a main character out, it would be him. But it is very concerned with kind of the idea of, you know, a band of brothers or a platoon or however you want to characterize this group of soldiers, and, you know, showing their camaraderie, showing their shared experience. And I think trying to communicate to the audience that this is sort of a representation of any soldier, you know, in this conflict. So the film doesn't seem very interested in traditional character development. And I don't mean that as a criticism necessarily, because I think the film is very concerned with an accurate depiction of war, insofar as, you know, what the technology at the time could accomplish. And I think it's quite successful in that regard. I mean, I had to remind myself a few times that this was made, you know, or released in 1930. It's like, wow, this is actually really impressive. A lot of the visuals here, a lot of the camera work, the editing, it feels very, very mature, you know, for a film that early. And again, just the fact that it is his first sound film, I just want to reemphasize, it just never felt really constrained by that, which is unusual for early sound films.
Well, maybe that's a good place for us to dive in a little deeper on the film. I think we can come back and circle to the way it handles the characters and the performances down the road here. But just focusing in on the direction from Pabst as he made this film. Like you said, it's his first sound film. And so he's himself learning as he's doing this. But he did find ways to make those creative camera setups, to move the camera through the trenches, to capture some of the visual excitement, or not even excitement necessarily, but the viscerality of being in this situation. But I think one of the things he does well with the sound is how he just has the sound effects, which, you said, are sometimes the synchronization's a little weak. Sometimes it just feels like it's the same sound effect over and over again. It probably was.
Yeah.
But, you know, the way he's peppering it in is just this constant background noise. You know, I thought that was really effective here in terms of giving you the sense of being at the front, right? You don't have, like, a constant sense of, like, wow, this thing's coming right at you. Like, oh, my gosh, the bomb's coming right at us, or the gunfire's zipping by you. It just sort of is there. It's just sort of a force. And when you have these shots of the terrain that are kind of just blown out, I mean, you kind of see the guys up close, but then you kind of look off into the distance. You really can't see anything. You go, like, wow, the war is just sort of a force unto itself. And I thought that was captured very nicely in the film without overstating it, because you could easily have done this in a way that would have maybe hammered home a little bit more that oppressive nature to the war. But it feels like the war in this is a force of nature in of itself, right? And there's a particular shot I really loved when it's the student. So Hans Joachim Mobius plays the student in this. And he's come to get the message out about how the artillery is actually just shelling their own people. And so he gets that message out. He gets a little bit of a meal as he's going to have to make his way back up to the front there. And just in the background, you have all these men just kind of popping up a little bit out of focus and kind of running around and coming back from no man's land and moving around. And I just thought, interesting visual choice there, right? The way in which they're directing this larger story, but you get the sense, I'm getting a sense of these characters, but the war itself is a much bigger reality than the story that I'm watching. And I thought that was an interesting way in which Pops decided to set the stage in terms of his filmmaking.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of scale to the film that really goes throughout. And the entire end of the film is essentially a very elaborate extended battle sequence, right? But I think that's one of the few times in the film that he really widens the scope fully, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas most of this film is very confined in many ways to interiors and to the trenches and kind of the dugouts within the trenches. And there's some effective, pretty frightening moments in this film too. I mean, that one part where a couple of soldiers were kind of supporting the roof of that dugout with their heads, mm-hmm. like this, you just get the sense that this soil is just going to collapse on them in any second. And just some real terrifying aspects of trench warfare that you don't necessarily think about. You know, you think about, oh, these guys are just in a hole in the ground kind of thing. And there are aspects and details here that that feel pretty horrifying. And some of the practical effects that they use to accomplish, you know, the ground collapsing and all this dirt falling in. I mean, some of that's really impressive. I'm just mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, I was kind of finding myself wondering how they did some of those shots. know, they must have built trapdoors underneath the dirt or however they did that. So some of the practical effects were effective and looked quite dangerous, actually, for the actors in some cases. So I was impressed by the technical execution of a lot of things here.
People just used to be a lot tougher when they made movies than they are now, right?
Yeah. I mean, you still have kind of that overly theatrical, you know, a soldier gets hit, he kind of stops and throws his hands up in the air and falls, you know, so there's still a very theatrical aspect to this film and a lot of the acting and performances, but that's forgivable considering its time period.
Yeah, I mean, it was the style of the time, and that actually continued on kind of death acting.
Yeah.
Continued really up until, I feel like, the 70s or maybe even Platoon in the 80s. I mean, it really was just so
pretty
common as a way of how to play those parts. You know, that scene you're describing there about the collapsing of the trench, right, as the guys are in the bunker. Again, that's one of those details I feel like really lends an authenticity to the film, because if you didn't have that, for example, I mean, it gave me an idea of like, oh, okay, this is why men in World War One would still be willing to get up and run over the safety of the trench into the no man's land with a mechanized army just watching them run across land to kill them.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't any safer being in the bunker, right? And I think so that's a detail that gives you a sense of an insight into the characters and into the history. That probably was because the people making the film and around it really had experienced this, right? Whereas even stuff that's being made about World War One years later, when you have much more realistic sense of the horrors of war and the kind of ability to create effects that show you what a tank does or a flamethrower does, right? Those movies don't seem to have those little tiny, subtle little things. Maybe not even subtle, it's just an interesting detail that makes the whole world come alive, right? And it's coming from, I think, that firsthand experience these people would have had making the film. But I like what the film doesn't do is become too polemical until the very end. I feel like at the end, the ending's not as successful as it could have been. But up until then, I mean, it really hits home sort of the sense of brotherhood. It's not becoming too never again kind of theatrics that you get in a lot of anti-war films. You don't have the stereotypical corrupt officer, right? Everyone seems to be actually doing their part well. The bond is, I think this is a really important part of the film's themes, that war, in a certain sense, brings these people together from all sorts of different backgrounds, and they connect with each other because of the intensity of the experience. You know, so you have these four main characters, basically, the lieutenant, the student, the Bavarian, and Carl, who we get the sense are not people that would have ever interacted with each other back home in Germany, but because of this, all of a sudden achieve a kind of equality with each other. And that, to me, is a really interesting point that the film pushes, because so often these kinds of films can become, and World War One in particular seems to always be a victim to this, where it's the callous, heartless officer corps that's sitting back away from the trench, and then they're just killing the infantry like nothing.
Yeah.
And this film doesn't go quite down that road. It does get a little heavy-handed in the end, but we can talk about that, I guess, a little later.
Yeah, I would agree. It's certainly not till the ending that it becomes very on the nose in terms of its messaging. But up until that point, yeah, it just seems very concerned with these characters, and again, their relationships, and not necessarily developing the characters individually. Though we do get that interesting portion of the film where Carl returns home. And that's, I think that's something we should focus on too, because not something you would necessarily expect. It kind of reminded me of that part in David Ayer's Fury.
I thought the same thing. I wonder if he was inspired by that.
I wonder.
I don't know.
Yeah, sort of that reprieve we get, you know, where the tank crew is having a meal with the German civilians. So it was very reminiscent of that. But in this case, he catches his wife with the butcher that works downstairs. And not exactly the warm reception that he was hoping for. But his reaction to that is quite interesting, I think. And he kind of chooses to ignore it to some degree. He knows that this may be the last time that he's home, and he's going to kind of make the most of it, regardless of, you know, a sense of betrayal that he may be feeling. So I thought that was a very well-handled scene. And the shot selection was very interesting, as well edited. So I really enjoyed that portion of the film. I was kind of caught off guard by that. You know, you expect this to be very combat oriented, very trench oriented throughout the entire picture, and you get this very personal portion of the film, and you see the relationship between him and his mother as well. But it also reflects on the suffering of civilians during war. You know, his wife clearly has gone hungry for a period of time, and they're standing in bread lines, and resources are scarce, and everyone's kind of desperate, even if they're away from the front. So I think the film is very clearly trying to point out the idea of shared suffering in the environment of war.
Yeah, that detail with his mother seeing Carl going into the apartment building, but not getting out of line because she's so close to being able to get the food. So there's the devastation of her kind of realizing this is wrong. I should want to run to my son, and yet I can't lose this opportunity because we are suffering so much here as well. I think that was a devastating little bit of the film. And I really love how that particular sequence was handled in terms of it's capturing, obviously, some of what you're saying, that the damage of the war is not limited to just the battlefield, right? It affects everything. And, you know, in a period of total war, like World War I would be, right, all of life, all of society is geared towards the war. So really, even the civilian back home, the parents, the spouse, children, whatever, they're all also in the war, even if they're not combatants, right? They are part of the war as well. And I think that film... the film captures that reality quite succinctly in that scene. And the way it's staged, particularly as it comes back, when he's going to be returning home with all these nice things too. I mean, he's going to have the stuff he wants to bring, 'cause he's got all the goals of what he wants to do to make it a special holiday for him and his family, when he comes home. But when it shows that line, right? I mean, it feels very much like, and the camera even pans much like it does when it's going through the trenches. So it's not like it's calling too much attention to itself, but it does feel like, oh, it's kind of the same cinematic language he's using for the trenches. And that connection of the two, I think, is really effective. And it's an example of the kind of filmmaking I wish we saw more of, that you, through just simple visual choices, communicate messages versus having it relied upon so heavily through dialogue. Because I could see how you could have easily written a line of dialogue of, you know, Carl walks by and he sees them and he says something like, wow, it's just like at the front, or, you know, it's something just to make sure the audience understands your point. Whereas this doesn't do that, and I think that level of just allowing us to absorb and reflect upon what we're seeing is a testament to Pabst as a director allowing his medium to actually be the message by which he wants to deliver, or the medium being the method by which he wants to deliver his message, in order to impact us in a visceral level, that happens through quiet reflection of what you're seeing versus being told, think this, up until that end, where he does really get to...
Yeah.
Think this, right? I think the ending sadly seems to betray what went right before, all the stuff that went before it, because it gets so obvious of what it's doing there. But otherwise, the film, I think, is really good in that it is pretty restrained in all regards.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to talk about the ending now? Or
Yeah, let's go for it. We've been hitting at it a couple of times. May as well.
Yeah, so as I stated earlier, there's a very extended battle sequence, which again is impressively staged. You know, I think this is where the sound kind of fails the picture to some degree, because the sync isn't great, and like you had mentioned before, it's a lot of reusing the same sound effects and sort of robs the sequence of some of its, I think, momentum. But be that as it may, it's still very well done, and some of the shots are very impressive. But yeah, we really see the full futility of this conflict in particular, right? I mean, this is the dawn of mechanized warfare in many ways, and that's really placed to the forefront. You know, we see the machine gun emplacements, we see the tanks, and the film is just not shying away from the just the tragic scale of slaughter, you know, that's taking place here. And once we're through that portion, it's personalized yet again with the death of the student, right? And we see him brawling in this muddy puddle, and the shot fades away, and we presume he was killed, and sure enough he was, and this is someone that Carl was quite close to. And there's kind of a chilling, haunting portion where they're in the trench there before the big final battle, and they're hearing someone yelling or screaming out on the battlefield, and Carl thinks it's the student, and his other fellow soldier is saying that it wasn't. He knows who it is. It was a French soldier, but Carl's still willing to risk going out to make sure it's not him. But eventually, when this attack starts, they do find his body, and that's a very chilling shot where they're burying him.
The hand protruding up out of the mud.
And just how the film plays on the reactions of the soldiers, right? Like, you know, the student is dead. We don't have to see his body, right? We don't have to see the aftermath of his struggle with the French soldier. And their faces really communicate, you know, what they found, and then the fact that they all kind of start silently digging to give him some sense of a burial in that moment is, you know, it's pretty heartbreaking portion of this film. But yeah, this is where things start to get very, very on the nose, right? So the battle takes place. Our characters are either wounded, or in the case of the lieutenant, he has a nervous breakdown and
goes shell shock.
Yeah, it goes insane, really, just shouting nonstop. And they're all taken back to the hospital. And this is where the film gets so on the nose, and it just kind of comes out of nowhere. Its anti-war messaging is very, very overt. You know, we're seeing these injured soldiers, we're seeing amputees, we're seeing soldiers coming out of surgery, and even things that are, you know, a soldier comes out of surgery and missing his legs. Like, we can see his legs are not there, but, you know, he has to wake up and say out loud that his legs are gone. Mm-hmm. Things that are kind of unnecessary in that regard, even though it's still impactful and still difficult to see these things and to see the characters' reactions to these things. This is where the film really starts to kind of lay on that obvious anti-war message. So, you can pick it up from here, Nate, if you want to describe the ending in more detail.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the battle scene's okay. I suppose at some point we'll need to kind of do a little bit of a compare contrast with this and All Quiet on the Western Front, since they are so close to each other, right? But, you know, the battle scene's okay. The setup and that sequencing of getting to the final push there, I think, is very effective, as you were describing it. And there is a harshness to seeing that protruding hand and the very vain attempt to try to give him a place of rest in this hell. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's all well done. When the battle happens, you know, that push happens, it's pretty brief. I mean, it's not like, you know, the Saving Private Ryan 30 minutes kind of deal.
Yeah.
So it's fine in that regard. A little dated because the technology wasn't perfect and they didn't quite have it mastered yet. But for the time and everything, I think it's still pretty impressive overall. It definitely is not as good as the battle scenes that Lewis Milestone does in All Quiet on the Western Front, which I think really capture the horror and the scale of the battles much better than this does. But when it gets to that hospital, and it's a very impressive tracking shot, you know, walking through which really is just an abandoned church. It's all blown up, and you know, you got the Stations of the Cross in the background. It's like, oh,
see the symbolism, you know, bombed out. Yeah.
Yeah. Symbolism, you know, like the suffering of the Christ and the suffering of humanity, you know, all tied in together. It's okay. It's interesting, you know, but it's also on the nose a little bit. And when it gets to the part where Carl is having this hallucination of his wife asking for forgiveness and him forgiving her and saying, we're all guilty. It's just so over the top. Yeah. And then he dies in a very prolonged shot of just holding on him, which fair enough, but it just seems to sit on it longer than maybe was necessary. But maybe there's a value of just letting you sit there, focus on it. Then the Frenchman comes to next to him as he gets covered with the cloth. And then the Frenchman holds his hand and says, not enemies, comrades.
Yeah.
You know, it's, let's put it this way. I can see why something like this made it so unpopular once the Nazis took over, right? This would have been like prime for them to say why we're going to ban this film. Not that I think it was going to fare well with Goebbels under any circumstances, which
certainly
is
not his
credit, by the way. But because it's so overt in those final minutes, you kind of go like, if you just scaled it back just a tiny bit, could it have been more powerful? Could it have been less of a polemic? Could it have worked more? Even the final credit is the end, ! That's like, it's almost like a parody.
It's like a student film. You know? It's like a student film ending.
Yeah, it's like almost like a parody. And you just kind of go like, oh, can't you just even change the credit just a little bit there? So that part, I feel, doesn't quite land.
Yeah.
Everything leading up to it seems to be so good and so subdued that the fact that it doesn't stay that way for like the final 3 minutes of the movie seems to really just be like, boy, you didn't dismount correctly.
Yeah, it's definitely a fumble. I mean, even though it could feel cliched now, I think at the time it probably would have worked fine if just all the soldiers were killed in combat. You know, something as simple as that to really drive home the idea of futility here.
The lieutenant being mad and just like, okay, he's maybe lived, but he's dead in a different kind of way. You know,
sure.
A walking death, a living death.
Sure. Yeah, I think that would have been effective enough. And the French soldier taking his hand is really like, wow, you know, that's really pushing it too far. You know, the other stuff I was like kind of cool with, but that bit was strange, I thought, especially for, it's like, we have no idea who this person is. And it took me a second to realize he was French. Like, they had his helmet right next to him, you know, just to make sure you really knew. And it was just a very unusual choice. And yeah, the question mark at the end, it seems so out of keeping with the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. And that's, I'm like, is this a producer? Is this a studio? Is this like early studio interference? I mean, what's going on here? It just, it's unusual.
Well, Pabst was definitely a pacifist, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he wanted this to be a pacifist plea. And he himself was, I don't know if he was actually officially a communist, but certainly left wing mm-hmm. in his politics. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me that he did do this. I'm sure it is his vision because everything else seems so perfectly realized. The question I wondered is, and I from the materials on the Criterion, you know, disc and everything here, are there parts that are still missing, right? You know, there was a lot, I guess, that they filmed that they didn't include. Now, some of it was purposely taken out by him. That's probably, I'm sure, lost for forever. But are there other elements that maybe got lost over the years? Like I said, this got banned by the Nazis, which, again, is to the movie's credit. But, you know, the fact that it, you know, fell out of circulation, what parts never got survived? You know, is that because I feel like maybe certain things could have worked better had you had some time to set up. I mean, it's a fairly short film. It's only 96 minutes. Now,
yeah,
movies in that day and age were not as long as they are now. So 96 minutes,
especially
that
is films. Not, yeah,
is not as short as it seems for us today. But, you know, it does move pretty quick through its story beats in this film. But I feel like maybe those final minutes could have been better had you just sort of slowed it down a little bit. I don't know.
Well, he's clearly trying to deliver a very harrowing and powerful final sequence, right? I mean, this is really meant to be the big climax of the film. The battle portions earlier are very brief, and if anything, it's a lot of it's communicated with the sound. But clearly the energy was really spent on this last portion of the film. And that's, you know, he probably felt like he needed to have an emotional ending that was in keeping with the scope of that battle sequence. That's probably the rationale here. But, you know, the futility of war is very self-evident here. It's like we we don't really need need things to be spelled out to that degree. And, you know, bringing his wife back into the picture at the end, too, is kind of interesting because, you know, it seems like he's forgiving her to some degree, right? You know, just thinking of her, wanting to see her again in those final moments, regardless of what she's done. And, you know, her character, it's hard to feel a lot of resonance there because she's really not much of a character in the film. And none of these characters really are either. You know, again, there isn't a lot of development. And again, I don't necessarily see that as a huge problem here, considering what the film is trying to do. But it does undercut some of the emotional payoff that the film is trying to deliver.
Well, let's maybe focus in a little bit on the characters here. So, as you said, they're fairly generic. Obviously, you know, we've had a century's worth of war films at this point. So it's very easy to have, okay, here's the young man who, you know, he has the young French girl that he falls in love with. Right. And,
yeah.
The more seasoned veteran who's kind of a little more gruff, but a little older and a little more world-wise. Right. So some of these types are cliched now, probably didn't feel that same way back when this would have been seen. I actually, one of the features I did like on the disc here is a French TV program that was a television broadcast of people, both French and German veterans of World War One, watching or discussing this movie after having watched it, and how moved they were by it, right? I mean, it really spoke to their experiences. So obviously these characterizations are based somewhat in the truth. I think the fact that, you know, most of them don't even have a name, they just have a title, you know, again, hits at the point of the fact that they kind of stand in for everybody. And even Carl's a very common name. It's not a unique name. And we don't even get his full name. I think I'm pretty sure he's just Carl. I don't think we ever learn a name beyond that. So, you know, the fact that they're all sort of just emblematic of all men in war, I think it is very evident. The performances, I think, work well. I really bought the camaraderie between these people.
Yeah, for sure.
The way they cover for each other, you know, how the student is himself in kind of has deserted to go spend time with the young French woman, and the way they cover for him to get him back to the front so that he doesn't get court-martialed and stuff like that. The interaction with Carl and the Bavarian when he comes back and learns of the student's death, right? The interaction of that feels very natural and kind of the way it would be relayed. Like, this is a matter of fact. This is a thing of life in the front. So yes, there's a devastation. You see it play out in Carl, but he doesn't get up and do his Oscar speech. You
know? Yeah.
This is all murder and madness and the futility of it all. You know, it's, you could tell he's thinking that and feeling it, but maybe doesn't even understand the words himself. Right. That there's a gut punch and a desire for him to still be alive out there, but also kind of a knowing he's not alive out there, right? And I think those are all captured nicely in the performances, even though it is a bit theatrical, even though some of the nuances that would be developed over time in screen acting aren't there yet. The film captures things pretty nicely, I think, especially for its era.
Yeah, I would agree. I think performances are effective overall. Carl is definitely the standout. You know, he's, as I mentioned earlier, if there's one main character to pull out, it's him. But even just the titles of the characters, the Bavarian, the student, you know, the lieutenant, as you said, it's really meant to represent multiple soldiers as opposed to a fully realized character.
Well, turning our attention just to the Criterion release here, this was, as I said, released on disc in 2018. It has also currently is on the channel, so people can stream it there if they want to take a look at it. It did undergo a pretty extensive restoration process, and there's a feature on the disc, I think it's also on the channel, that goes through how they combined two different elements. So there was a copy that the BFI had, and then there's a copy that the Germans themselves had, and they took the two together and they realized certain things were in one, certain things were not in the other. And you know, so there were some scenes in one that didn't exist in the other one and vice versa. And there's also certain parts that were just missing, you know, between certain shots. And so they were able to go through a slow process of reconstructing it to get us the version we have now, which, like I said, is at 96 minutes in length. I think it looks pretty good. There's obviously some natural decay that has occurred that you're just going to have because of the quality of this film storage and the age of the image, but it looked really good on the disc here. I have the Blu-ray. How does it look on the channel? I assume you just streamed it?
Yeah, it looks really nice. I mean, the restoration is pretty impressive. I mean, the some nice film grain, image is stable, doesn't look too beat up, or, you know, the contrast doesn't look too blown out, which you sometimes see with films of this era. So yeah, really well done.
Yeah, they didn't overdo it as they restored it, which is also a danger. As you're trying to fix it up, you overdo your work and you reveal your hand in touching up the image. So I thought it looked great. It does have some nice features on it. So as I referenced, there's that hour-long French television broadcast that had actual veterans of the World War from 1969 discussing it. There's also an interview from a film scholar, Jan Christopher Horek, who spoke about the nature of the film and how it fits into Pabst's filmography, as well as just sort of the story of the movie in its initial release. And then a very brief audio clip from the editor, Jean Oser, who in 1988 answered some questions and explained some of the choices that they made as well. So a nice collection of supplements here that help give a little bit more sense of the depth of the film and its place in cinema history. I think a very successful release overall from the collection. Which brings us to our final question of the night. Matt, does Westfront 1918 belong in the Criterion Collection?
I'm going to have to say no on this one. I mean, I think it's a good film. You know, it's significant insofar as this being Pabst's first sound film. But I can think of, you know, better representations of, you know, World War One on film. You mentioned Paths of Glory, which is also in the collection, of course. You know, Beyond, All Quiet on the Western Front. Still a strong film. Definitely enjoyed it, but not something I would immediately think of including.
Yeah, this is a perfect, if the Eclipse series was still going, this would be a perfect thing for that.
You know? Yeah.
Not Criterion, but Criterion adjacent. Because I don't know that it actually had much of an impact on cinema, right? Because it was taken out of regulation for so long. And, you know, it wasn't until just now that we really got an ability to watch the film close to what Pabst would have wanted. I mean, can we say it's an important film? Probably not. And, you know, I do think that there are interesting things it does. There are ways in which it does give glimpses of the war, but at the same time, All Quiet on the Western Front, if you're looking at a film from this era, much more successful. If you're looking at the transition from sound to from silent to sound, maybe in that regard, you could say this is an interesting film to study from that perspective. But I think there are other ones as well that, achieve the same purpose. And I don't know that there's a lot that's gained from watching this film for somebody. So I would ultimately have to draw the same conclusion, as much as I don't really like it, because I really do think this is a good movie. But I don't think it belongs in the collection. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for our conversation here this evening. Please join us next month when we will be discussing Hiroshima Mon Amour. Thank you, and keep collecting.